I'm going to go pretty much down the outline, I anticipate. And let me say this, the first half, which is scored discussions, is going to actually be the bulk of the seminar. The graded Socratic probes, you'll see by the time we get there why I'm not going to stay there real long. But before you leave today, you have the scored discussion handout, and before you leave, be sure and come up and get the graded Socratic probe handout. Or perhaps when we get to it, I'll ask some of our lovely beauties and our strong, handsome guys to hand out those to you. Also, after the scoring aspect of this Roman numeral number one on the handout, which I think is G, we will have a true scored discussion. But, well, we're going to have a discussion by these fabulous junior high students, and then we will score, because you can use to practice that score sheet that you just received. It's the second page of the handout you have. We'll go through it, and then you get to practice scoring. And we won't peel you, okay? But you know, we're gonna talk about you a little bit. And it's practice for you. I told the kids we were going to do this, and I said, it's not about you, darling. It's about these teachers and parents practicing doing the score. And then we'll debrief and on to Socratic probes. All right. Are we ready? Yes? Okay. Score discussion, Roman numeral number one. I don't know if very many of you have heard of the term. It's kind of a buzz about in education now, has been for about 10 years, scored discussions. I don't know, it could mean that you're scoring up a piece of me or something. I don't know, what is it? Okay. It's an unplanned but planned. It's an unplanned discussion in the classroom among a small group of students, usually 3 to 5 people. And it's among the students in the classroom. So what I do is I'll say, you four, you're in a discussion, and it'll be you and you and you and you. They never know who it's going to be. And I say it's unplanned. There's nothing for them to do to plan for it, really, but it's planned in that I say, okay, it's Thursday. We're going to do some score discussions on Thursday. And sometimes it's, you know, ideas are forthcoming on Wednesday to delay it to next Monday, but it's going to be Thursday. And so we put them, they pull their chairs up, and they're right here in the middle of the classroom, and all the rest of the classroom is around them. And why would we hold a scored discussion? Well, it's held at the end of a study. Now, I do it in junior high and in high school. So these junior hires, what I teach is literature. So they're discussing the end of a book or concept issues, aspects of literature that we've been discussing. They've taken class notes on it, they've been reading the book, they've been journaling, they've done a whole lot of things about this book. Or if it's high school students, and I teach the humanities in high school, so it will be about a political issue, it could be about a document, an event, an era, a movement, you know, all kinds of things there. Okay, so it's usually, I mean it is, it's toward the end of a study we've been doing for maybe weeks, or maybe 10 days or something, because you can't get a good discussion going if we haven't prepared for it in just our normal studies. And this is the beautiful thing about a scored discussion. To hold them, there's nothing forced about it. They've got lots of information and experiences before you hold one. So you certainly aren't going to schedule in your teacher planner a scored discussion 4 days into a Shakespeare play. It won't work. But maybe 4 weeks, yeah, that's great. Okay, and the third aspect of this definition, unplanned discussion among a small group held at the end of a study. Number three, the third aspect is the scoring results in a grade for each individual. They're earning their own grade. But it's not each man out for himself. They need each other desperately. You can't talk to the wall. And you know what? We've seen it in the classroom where there's just a downright flat group. Nobody's saying anything. They're brain dead. They can't remember. I don't know what it is. But each one is out for their own grade, so they are dependent on the comments that their colleagues are making. Therefore, they want to encourage their colleagues' comments with the ones they initially make. I mean, I can't hold a discussion with this beautiful young lady right here if she's only going to say yes and no to me. There's no way. All right. And the point of a scored discussion, the purpose and the point, I think that's in it. That's in that same section A under Roman numeral 1. The point is the student gets to get out what he knows. How many times do you hear from your students, gee, I studied this. It was a final exam in humanities this year, and one of the students asked, now, Mrs. Morwood, all first semester and part of the beginning of the second semester, you were asking, how was the Russian Revolution similar to the French Revolution? How was the China's Revolution, Communist Revolution, similar to the French Revolution? How was Cuba similar to the French Revolution? I know you're going to be asking that. I didn't ask it. And he was just sick. So, you know, how many times have those kids studied some aspect of your notes and you don't give them any open door? You've forgotten or something to give a wide or broad enough essay question that they can squeeze in some way what they know and connect it, which is that's what we're all about in the dialectic and the rhetoric, is that they make these connections, they can compare or contrast or give consequence, you know, cause and effect or something to squeeze in what they know. Well, in a scored discussion, they can do it. But the hardest thing for this age group, the junior high age group, is to squeeze it in. The older they get, the better they are at turning a conversation where they want to go. If I were going to be in discussion with this gentleman about science, and I don't know a darn thing about science, I want to continue the conversation because he's rather intriguing, I would turn it as best I could to something that science and the humanities share, so I can get in on it. Well, that's what you have to do with a scored discussion. The younger they are, the more terribly difficult it is for them to do. So they're learning. Okay, so he gets to get out what he knows. Also, he can get out all he knows. On it, it's a good way. Okay, purpose of scored discussions is it's another means for you of evaluation, for one thing. Tests are great, papers are great, writing on demand is great, journaling, anything they turn in for a grade, but this is another interesting and useful tool to evaluate what a student knows. It gives practice. Number two on this, it gives practice to the tools, the skills of rhetoric. We want them to speak with eloquence. We want them to speak truth. We want them to speak with clarity. We want them to speak with reason, goodness, truth, and beauty, and all that. Well, they can practice doing it spontaneously with what's in here. But also, number three, it forces them to, of all the things that we do in the classroom with speeches and lecturing and everything else, you know, you've seen students, they can check out the classroom and still somehow do well. They can daydream and still do well, sort of. Well, in this case, they can't. So it forces them to listen. They must listen. They must contribute or they have no points. They must learn to turn the conversation or they have less points. So it forces them primarily to listen. When we watch these four have a discussion, you might be able to tell who it is that's just thinking how they're going to get in. They aren't really listening, and then they can naturally get in. You have to listen. There's a Shakespeare troupe here in town. They are superb, and many times I've heard people say to them, how can you make Shakespeare seem like everyday language? How do you make it so that I, sitting in the audience, hearing it once, know what you're saying? And so they answer it over and over again. We are committed to Shakespeare. That's all the plays we do. And number two, we've been taught to listen. Even though I know those words by heart, even though I've been practicing for weeks and I've practiced and practiced and practiced and practiced, and I know that scene in the tomb between Romeo and Juliet. Backward, I'm going to do it in a coma when I'm dead. I know it so well. Even though that I must listen to that other character on the stage as if it's the first time I've ever heard it. Therefore, I respond because I'm listening to the first thing. And that's what has to happen in a scored discussion. They have to listen or they can't get in. It gets stilted. They're going to lose points or they're going to be penalized points. So it's great for that. Okay, number B there, the advantages. You know there's myriads. I know you're sitting here thinking about your history class or your literature, your science or your math. If you're a math teacher, let me encourage you, please use scored discussions on how you could use it in how to solve a particularly difficult problem. You could use scored discussions in any discipline. I've just used them in English and history because those are the only things I know, and I barely know those. Okay, so there's a myriad of advantages, but let me just say a couple, a few here that are important to me. We have protocol classes at Mars Hill Academy where they learn the proper manners and behavior for eating certain kinds of foods and how many courses at the meal table and what to do when they're out and how to respond to a man when he wants to escort you and things like that. But I don't know that anybody has protocol classes in how to in the art of conversation. And so you know that they know how to do it, though, because you hear these kids in the class, in the hallways of your schools, and man, are they talking. They're a mile a minute, and they can go from subject to subject to subject, and they've got all the transitional words and phrases, and they did it just beautifully. But doing it in an intellectual or a scholarly setting is rather challenging because they aren't talking about Lord of the Rings, and they aren't talking about their new shoes, and they aren't talking about the baseball game, connecting them all as smoothly as possible. They're trying to talk about an aspect of Elizabethan theater or, you know, this sort of thing. So I think one of the advantages of scored discussion is with an intellectual content, they can practice the art of conversation because you can tell by the score sheet they are penalized with monopolizing. Well, don't you just hate to be around a monopolizer and you've got some things to say and you're on your end of the conversation with your mouth open all the time just waiting for a chance to say something? Don't you just hate it when somebody interrupts all the time and all the time and interrupt and interrupt and they interrupt all the time? So forget it. I think I'll think about my grocery list. I'm not even going to try to talk because I know you're going to interrupt. Okay, the art of conversation penalizes the same things that are the negative points on that score sheet. And another reason I think another advantage is it adds energy to the classroom. Anything that puts some of the learning in the laps of the students where they control it to some degree adds energy. They get more excited, they get more drawn in. They're important. And I think of all the levels and ages of kids, the grammar kid, the child, the logic and dialectic junior high, the rhetoric, I think the most exciting to work with in many cases is the junior high student because they have just grown into the stage in life when they want to have an opinion on everything and they think their opinion really has a whole lot of weight, so they'll express it. Whereas you get into the junior year, they really want to have an opinion, but they aren't going to express it because they're beginning to see they've hit the mountain. The older you get, the more you realize there's so much to know, so much wisdom to be gained, and you are so foolish. And the more you learn, the more you learn how foolish you are and how unwise you are and how uninformed you really are, the more you grow through life. It's like looking at sin, you know, you just get convicted all the time. But the junior higher doesn't realize yet how much there is to know, and so he's more ready to give his opinion on things, and so they're more fun in the classroom, I think. You get a lot of energy going with these kids. Another advantage is it adds a rich dimension. This kind of conversation adds rich dimension to their experiences in reasoning and with logic. I tried to take logic this last year. I lasted through December in Mr. Brinkerhoff's logic class, and I had to drop out. For one thing, I couldn't do the exercise, and for another reason, they were just blowing me out of it. You know, they were right on it, and I was really struggling with it, so I'm going to give it another attempt. But they can exercise their syllogisms and the fallacies, and one of the negative points is when someone's made an irrelevant comment. Well, they're going to do it with logic. because they're learning it in the seventh and eighth grade year. That's when they take those classes. So you got another dimension. If they are going to use what they learn in one class into the other, which is a maturity thing. Some kids are still separating their classes. Oh, this is English. It has nothing to do with anything else. This is math. It has nothing to do with anything else for sure. This is, or whatever. And but if they're a little bold and growing and maturing, then they might decide they're going to use that logic syllogism in this debate here or this scored discussion right here. Another advantage is it's a good for review. Painless. Painless review. Because when we do them, I say, okay, we've got a score discussion on Thursday about Romeo and Juliet, and I want you to consider the similarities between Juliet and Rowena in Ivanhoe, which we had done at the beginning of in the fall, because there are some similarities. Or I want you to have a discussion on the moral tone in Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde and compare it to the moral tone in Henry James' Turn of the Screw. The comparison's huge because there's actually the moral tone in Turn of the Screw is just null and void. There is nothing beautiful, anything in that, whereas in Jekyll and Hyde there is. Or, you know, so it's a great way to review some of those old concepts. This year we went back to the first things in literature where we looked at just the distinctives of literature that everybody has to do, you know, theme, setting, characterization, conflict, and that sort of thing. So we could constantly review those when I say we're having a score discussion on those aspects of this short story or whatever. Okay, so those are just some of the myriad advantages. Okay, what about dialectic discussions? And I want to encourage you to share about with your other teachers above your grade and below your grade when these things are happening. We had the sixth grade as a guest this year. Kids were doing a score discussion on Ivanhoe in the fall, and the sixth grade came in. Oh, they thought they were cool because they were in seventh and eighth grade class. And they came in and they brought their chairs and they had their notebook and they just sat there and they watched and they wrote and they wrote and they wrote. And I don't know what the other teacher discussed with them when she went back to her room, but she had prepared them to observe a scored discussion and observe how the discussion went so that they could debrief when they went back. But I did sort of learn because there was one young man that followed me around the school for about a week and wanted to give me his opinions on what he thought. So I get to have him in my class. He has real dark hair and his mother directs plays. Okay. Okay, let me tell you how to prepare the dialectic kids. And this is, you would know that because y'all are teachers, but I think I'll just go over this for the sake of any new teachers. First, you would explain the protocol of this with your class. So I use this handout that you have, and we read that first page over, we read through it, we discuss it, we give some examples, and by the time we get to the negatives, they're a little worried. Because for the dialectic student, the negatives are overwhelming. They don't want to lose points. And that's what they're thinking about almost the whole time. So, but anyway, it's a learning process, and they'll go through quite a few scored discussions before they decide to forget about that. There's some other things that are more important. So we go through that handout, and we practice scoring, just like you're going to do today. And I try to encourage them. Oh, I have heard that some people have, I did hear of another classical school in the East that is doing scored discussions. This one man is doing them. And he insists that while they're in their discussion, they raise their hand. How would you like to raise your hand and have me call on you before you say your earnest response to each other? Well, I can't imagine anything more horrible. Okay, so we're in these great classical schools, and in this room are some of the elementary student teachers that hand me beautifully trained students. They're beautifully trained by these teachers, and they know to raise their hand, and they're very respectful. But in a score discussion, not necessary, okay? They're going to get points off, and they're going to get an F. That's worse, I think, for a junior high student than requiring of the certain. So relax some of your things here. So I make sure that they understand this is spontaneous. get in if you can, because they're going to take the hard knocks with losing points if they interrupt because they're too spontaneous. Okay, so we go through that. We practice it. We practice with putting the score sheet or on an overhead, and I give everybody in the classroom a copy of the score sheet. And so I stand there and I'm scoring, and they're scoring, and some poor little victims are in the middle of the room practicing so that in 8 minutes or so we can tear them apart. We really won't, but you know, it's that feeling, I think. And we do that. I think we only did it once, I think, didn't we? I don't know. You probably don't remember. It was way back, a long time ago, the beginning of the year. Okay, and when we were doing that one time, several of the students were quite upset because I had not counted down somebody who was interrupting all the time. Yeah. Look the other way. Make sure nobody knows. Okay, and let me encourage you to encourage your idea generators. There's always a student that's just an idea generator. When they get something out on the table, everybody flies. Everybody flies. But if you don't have an idea generator in the group, you got a flat group. So take care when you give your groupings, when you pick Sybil and Joey and Steve to get out here, make sure that you've picked some, you put one idea generator in there. Okay, because it helps everybody else. So we practice this, of course. One thing you must make sure that those kids understand, that is, they won't be penalized for monopolizing if they are 30 seconds or under when they have the floor. And I recommend that you tell them we're going to have a score discussion on Thursday, class. Here's how you prepare. And there's two ways, because it's an unplanned thing. Just look over all your notes of so-and-so, so-and-so, because you'll have fresh meat. And number two, practice 30-second blips. Talk out, read the book you're reading out loud to yourself for 30 seconds. Have a conversation with your mom and time what you say and see how many seconds it is. Or so that they get aware of the 30-second thing. Because when they are talking for a minute or whatever, they're monopolizing and they've lost points. I think 3 points. I can't remember for sure how much it is. So those are the two things you can do to have them prepare a little bit. For the junior high, the dialectic discussion, I'd say 5 to 10 minutes, no longer. Ten is big. Start with 5 at the beginning of the year. Okay, another aspect. We've tried different approaches. For one thing, we've tried, of course, we always do different groupings, but also we've tried different ways. One time, Kate, young lady in the periwinkle there, suggested we had been discussing something. I guess it was Ivanhoe, I'm not sure. And she said, Mrs. Morwood, could you just give us our groups, assign us our groups, we'll chat on the phone tonight, and then we'll come and we'll do a score discussion, and it'll just be all our idea. Because how I started is I put a question or a statement on the board, and they have to exhaust that, but they can take their discussion where they want to go as long as they exhaust that statement or question. Well, you know, how do you score somebody for what they know if you haven't given them anything that's important for you to know? It's like coming to an exam and it's a blank paper. There's nothing on it. Oh, just write. You just write what you want to about Genesis, you know. So that's a pretty good idea she had, and I think it would be okay to do every once in a while, because they can plan, they can have their statement they're going to get out, they can call their buddies, because I've assigned a group. I never let them just pick their group. I got to assign the group, because you got to have certain personalities, certain kinds of speakers in the group, or it'll fall flat. And so, you know, that's okay to do that every once in a while. I think there is some value, but usually not. Here's something to do. I've come before with some statements or questions on an overhead, and I'll have it so that they can see 3 of them. And then I'll say, start with one of them. You pick which one and exhaust it, and then move your conversation to cover the other two. And here's a sample. Three sample statements or questions. These are all on Ivanhoe. Explain how Rebecca, a Hebrew, an unbeliever in Jesus, is Scott's representative of an ideal Christian. And why do you think he did this? Had a Hebrew unbeliever as representative of the ideal Christian woman. So that's one question. Number two, and explore Ivanhoe himself, the character of Ivanhoe, the disinherited son, who proves himself a faithful and courageous son to his father, Wilfred, a faithful and courageous subject, friend, and rescuer. Explore Ivanhoe, the character. The disinherited son, who indeed is a good son to his father, his nation, and his fellow man. And C, the third question. How is Rowena, the stylized medieval woman, how is she just a symbol of the medieval woman? And what was Scott's purpose in stylizing Rowena the Gentile and focusing on Rebecca the Hebrew? Okay, those are the three things. And they're on an overhead, and they can start with one. They've got to exhaust it, and they've got to move to the other ones, and they have 8 minutes. In a discussion where they can get some things out on the table, but whether they earn any more points or not is greatly dependent on their colleagues and what they say. Because I can come to this gentleman and start talking about Rowena, but if he has nothing to say back, I'm going to have to keep doing the talking, and then I have no points. I have an F. No. So, okay, you can only anticipate the difficulties here. Okay, that's the dialectic discussion section, and this is where they learn to do it, is in the dialectic years. I do not suggest you do it with anybody younger, although you can, you know, march your sixth graders in to observe. Okay, as to rhetoric discussions, now let me say this. There's no teacher input. Once it starts, I'm not in it. I'm scoring. So these are students only. They own it. It's in their lap. In the rhetoric discussions, there's no teacher in it, but there's been several times when I just couldn't resist. And we had a good long discussion, 30 minutes. The students had a discussion. I don't say we. I was just there. The students had it. That exciting discussion, Amy, on Age of Innocence that we did. And, I had to make about four statements. And I didn't make a statement to get in the discussion. I stepped in with, well, what about so-and-so? Because I could see that they were turning it. And I didn't want them to turn it yet until something got out on the table about that book. And I could see in the way they responded that every time I did that, they went more. So you do need your idea generators. You do need your people that can put out some things on the table that are laden with several ideas so that the other discussion participants can grab one and go with it. But the ideas are already on the table, so somebody else might go back to what the idea generator said. And you see what I mean? It can go on for minutes. Okay, we do up to 30-minute discussions in the rhetoric classes. One lovely young lady asked if she could make some note cards. The first time, I don't like those legs. I'm going to fall down. She asked if she could make some note cards in preparation. I said, well, yes. I mean, if you wish, that's fine. Especially in history, if there's dates or a list or points in a document or something like that, they can bring note cards. But what if this gentleman and I were in a discussion and all I had was note cards, and before I said anything, I had to go through my note cards, had to find it. He's like, I think I'll find somebody else to have a discussion with. It's not very effective, but yet it's helpful if your discussion is dense in terms of facts of some sort. So you can allow it, but suggest that it might hinder them getting into the discussion, because you know how discussions flow. The moment's over pretty, in a few seconds. And that person might be still going through the note cards. So this lovely young lady eventually experienced that. Also, you are going to have inevitably in your score discussion, shy people, people that just aren't verbal, they don't assert themselves, they're reticent. And while in the high school years, in the dialectic years, too bad. You know, I don't have a whole lot of sympathy. But in the high school years, I do, because every grade they earn is averaged into a grade that goes on a transcript. And they're thinking about college and their future. And I just think it's rather cruel to let them flounder around in slimy water. So if you, with your shy and reticent speaker, and those students do get better if you have them frequent enough. I will privately pull that person aside and ask them to do some extra work. Do a 2-page paper, do something on that topic that the score discussion was on to bring the grade up. But they won't be able, no matter how sterling the paper is, it won't come any higher than a B. But at least they got that. And see, if I made it too easy to where they could get an A+ or an A on that paper, then why ever learn to get in a discussion in the first place? Some will be content with a B and others will not, but they'll do better next time. Okay, in the rhetoric classroom 2 years ago, one of the students asked, well, Mrs. Morwood, you know, I think this was a student that just wasn't prepared, but he said, Mrs. Morwood, can I score? I want to score. So we started a little tradition where I'm scoring, but one of the rhetoric students can score with me. He's got his own score sheet, and we're both scoring, and it rotates. So what I do to take the grade on the scores, because to me this is practice to learn these things that might take into their adulthood, and I average the highest score on each individual aspect of their score discussion. So if the scorer did it, and it's higher than my score, then I'll take his score. If my score is higher, I'll take mine. Okay, to give as much as I can to the ones that are participating in the discussion. So that became something that we always did until lately. I think the last one we did, nobody wanted to score. And the advantage of that was they learned how hard it is to listen back and forth in a discussion and value it like that, because they had to put, we just do those little scratches, what are they called, where you do four and then you do one? Okay, we just do those right there, and then we add up the points for each section there. And they learned how difficult it is. It's easier to get in the discussion for the student scorer and me on the rhetoric level. The only time ever that the students have a score sheet is when we're practicing, when they're first exposed to it. No, I take this score sheet, and it's smaller, and it has the same content here squeezed together without the spacing, with every student's name next to it. So Sybil's, so-and-so, so-and-so. And you have to keep going up and down the sheet there to get the right score on there. Okay, you'll figure it out. It's not even... Okay, preparation of the students. You tell them what day you're holding it. Maybe you might review some of the notes at the end of the year with these students. We had the whole board was full with these columns. The columns at the top were the conflict in this story, the characterization, what was unique about this author's characterizations in this story, moral tone, setting, theme, and the era, the literary era, because this group had studied literary eras all year and who the greats were in those eras. So that. And then we went across those columns with all the things we read. And we talked about what was it about Turn of the Screw and the characterization with that governess. I mean, she didn't even have a name. When was that written? Well, it was at the end of the Romantic era. And they had prized mystery. Okay, what about Ivanhoe? What about so-and-so, so-and-so? And we reviewed all this thing. It took 2 days to do that. Filled up the whole board. I'm not lecturing and telling it. I'm asking questions. They're saying this and this. They're frantic in their notebooks, getting out those old notes, trying to find it. And we're putting bullet points. And so that was the review, so we could have the final discussion, score discussion, on the entire year. They didn't like it very well because it was like the last week of school. But anyway, it's just an idea. Okay, suggestions? We're almost getting there. We're almost to you. Remind the students whenever you're doing score discussions and analyzing and debriefing at the end that they are for the purpose of exchanging ideas. Yes, they're going to get graded, but it's to exchange ideas. And that is one of the most lovely aspects of being a human all of our lives, to exchange ideas. I had a lovely lunch with some of my colleagues and a board member today, and it was exhilarating because of the fellowship and the love and the beauty that was being expressed between us. And we did exchange ideas. It was fabulous. So this is, encourage them about this. Also, remind yourself that any problems you have with this, flat discussions that can't get going, that fall flat after like a minute and a half and things like that, that if this experience in your classroom is a thinking issue, and you know kids can take notes, they can memorize, they can study, they can regurgitate it back on a test, but if they haven't thought about it, I don't know how much they have to say. And the score discussion lets them learn they really don't have anything to say if they don't think. Also, you know what? It also showed me that the lecture, note-taking, testing, paper, lecture, note-taking, testing, paper cycle is often sterile if a student isn't engaging in his education himself, and it comes out in discussions. Also, be willing to analyze your students. There is a student in our class, a young man, who has a particular insight into literature. Whenever he says anything, he said some really good stuff. But he's not as verbal. He's not as talkative. He won't get it out as much. And so my task and your task for those kinds of students is to tell them the consequences of broadening their comments, getting in the conversation a little bit more, because they generate another 4 minutes or more of conversations. His ideas and his statements can bring up 7 or 8 different comments from their colleagues. So encourage that kind of a student. You might also discourage one who has great ideas, who's very verbal, and is trying to help the conversation and ends up and interrupts too much or monopolizes too much. You got to show them the importance of debriefing with these kinds of things so that they see what they're doing, what's going on. Just a list of some suggestions here. Encourage them to be at ease. You create the atmosphere in your classroom. And my expectations are pretty big, pretty tall, but I want them to know they're loved, and the classroom is a safe place. So you encourage them to be at ease. Encourage them to say what they mean. They can give opinions in score discussions. Well, I'm sorry, it can't just be an opinion that's not backed up. They better have an analysis of some sort with their opinion or a metaphor or something. But say what they mean. Ask them to try for the meeting of the minds. Encourage them to have an end in view. The discussion's going to be over, and have they said what they want to say? Or could say, have an end in view. Encourage them to make connections. If it reminds them of something in logic, if this discussion reminds them of something, some book they read at the beach 2 summers ago, if it reminds them of a movie, make connections, because that's bringing our studies into real life. Encourage them to keep going in their discussion, even until they sense the discussion's dead, that it's tiresome. Just let it die. And the whole thing will end before the time allotment. Because nothing's worse than just... We'll encourage them to be thoughtful about those kinds of things. help them and show them in your debriefing how they could have adapted this or that comment or shifted the focus in what was said. Teach them to use descriptive words when they're making their comments, because those always bring up new ideas. Also, encourage them to bring in a diversity of interests and perspectives. Ask them if they're, when they're talking to each other in a scored discussion, if they're really seeking their colleagues' opinions or if they're just trying to get in. Encourage them to appeal to other people's curiosity and other people's creativity when they broaden, like that young man I was telling you about that always has such wonderful things to add that doesn't get in very much, that just won't. Encourage him to consider how he fulfills other his colleagues' quest, curiosity, and their creativity because he's put something out on the table. Encourage them to share mutual perspectives. That's another way to get into a conversation. I agree with you, but let me add this. I think it's even wider than what you said, Sybil. You know, those kinds of encourage them, model, mimic it for them in the classroom when you're going over this and discussing it, and also remind them to make connections. Okay, on your sheet there on the scoring, you can see the points. You don't know who these kids are, so you might make, if you want to use the sheet, okay, if you want to use another sheet, you might say green tie, red tie, periwinkle, and beautiful girl. What do you say about Ashley? No, let me introduce these people. Okay, who's Mike?
What grade is he in?
Eighth.
Okay, this is on a tape, so tell them what. I'm Mike.
Oh, yes. I'm Michael Peters, and I'm going to be in the eighth grade next year.
And why are you here today, girl?
To do the score discussion. I'm here because I need to do the score discussion.
Force, huh? Were you forced? No, Mrs. Smart, I wasn't forced.
No, Mrs. Smart, I wasn't forced.
Okay.
I am Ashley Spielberg, and I'm going to be a freshman at Marshall Academy this year.
I'm Katie Ryan, and I'm going to be a freshman also at Marshall Academy next year.
I'm Ben Cox, and I'm going to be an eighth grader at Marshall.
Thank you, Ben, and Kate, and Ash, and Mike. Okay, are you ready to go on the discussion? Now, are you going to begin with some kind of definition or something, or
yes,
somehow acclimate us to this discussion rather than being so rude as to make us listen to something we're not privy to? All right, okay.
Well, we met a few days ago, and we decided to talk on The Great Chain of Being and its effect on Romeo and Juliet by William Shakespeare. And before we start, we thought we'd give you an explanation of what is the chain of being so you can semi-follow what we're talking about through the rest of the discussion.
Well, the chain of being is a term that... Okay. The chain of being is a term that refers to an elaborate system of parallels and correspondences that govern the orthodox Renaissance views of the cosmos. And so the chain of being was this sort of a food chain that... with God at the top and angels and the heavenly bodies and people, including even the minerals. It was a chain of authority that started with God and then went down to the angels and then the spheres and then people and then animals and so on and so forth. It was a level of who had authority over who. So, and then within each category there were subcategories such as the king was the ruler of the people group, and then under him was the nobles and the common people and so on. And then in the household, the man was at the top, the woman was under him, and then the children were under him. This was the philosophy in the Renaissance era.
Worldview.
Worldview.
Okay, can you put the mic closer? Cause... All right. Okay.
When you're studying Shakespeare, it's important to keep this in mind because whenever the people of his time would look at something, they would always keep the chain of being in mind. And so if they saw something being misplaced in the chain of being, they would know that destruction and tragedy was going to happen.
Right. For example, when you had Romeo and Juliet, they died in the end because they went against the people in authority over them. So if something is messed up in the chain, you would have chaos run through the entire thing.
And again, another example is seen when the prince has ordered the people not to fight, and yet the people still fight when taunted, thus going over, surpassing the ruler's command, thus breaking the chain.
And the chain worked in perfect harmony, and where if any of the objects under the chain got out of place, it resulted in utter chaos or death, as in the case of Romeo and Juliet.
Okay, now stop. I want you to get so you're facing each other, because it feels like you're just giving a report.
Another example is when Friar Lawrence says that women may fall when there's no strength in men. This is saying that when men follow their passion, then women will fall. And since in the chain of being, which is shown in man's mental mind, it starts with his reason, and then his intuition, and then his will, and then his passion. So when he puts his passion in front of reason, intuition, and will, then he disrupts the chain of being.
I think that's kind of has to do with taste. It's another thing that is all throughout Romeo and Juliet, is how people were so hasty. I mean, the entire play takes place in 5 days. Do you think that haste was one reason that Romeo and Juliet were killed? Because since they were so hasty, they put their passion in front of everything else, it killed them eventually?
Well, haste played a big part in it. In the prologue, before the play starts, it talks about how the families broke out in new strife, and a pair of star-crossed lovers took their life. And so haste played a part in it, but it was because that the whole chain, if you would say, the whole chain was upset, that the whole, because of the families' strife between each other, and that's how it resulted in their death. And so haste did play a big part in it.
Well, as we were saying, the star cross, it means that the fates are controlling their fate. And so it's saying that they can't escape from this doom that's going to happen. And this is also shown in the beginning when the prince puts the warning over the town that if they fight, somebody is going to die. When they feud and disobeyed his orders, you see the outcome, and they died.
Right. Does everyone agree with the fact that it was the fates and not just their parents?
Well, it was
caused the death. Sorry. Go ahead.
Well, it was their parents that caused the strife, because the chain was upset because of their parents, because of the two families, and so that's what caused.
But the parents also were forcing Juliet to marry. And with that, when Juliet did not want to marry Paris, she decided to go against her father's will, again toppling the chain of being. So it could also have been their parents' decision, as Ashley was saying, that caused her downfall.
I think that it was the fates that put them in their position and gave them the opportunities that they had to make wrong decisions. But in the end, it was their own decisions that finally brought them to their end.
I disagree. I think that through the entire, within the world of the play, that from the very beginning when it quotes, let's see, a pair of star-crossed lovers take their life. So star-crossed is that destiny is against them. They thought in, you know, astrology and everything, that the fates controlled their life. So I think that the fates decided, I mean, destiny had taken place. There was nothing that they could do to prevent it. Like we were talking about, I forget the word that it is, but when a man finds out, like in Epitius Rex, that he finds out that his fates are against him and he fights so hard, but it still doesn't work.
Mm-hmm. And Juliet even played a big role in it because, in the downfall, because a Renaissance girl at that time was a submissive, obedient girl to her father, and how she turned against the whole family and married Romeo, which was arch enemy, that also played a part in their whole downfall.
What do you think the outcome would have been if Juliet would have obeyed her father's order? Would the fates still have been against her if she died in the end? But if she had followed her father's will and married the one that she had been told to, would she still have been, would she still have died in the end?
I don't think she would have, because going against her father was the crime that shook up the whole chain of being. Going from underneath her father's authority and marrying who she wanted to is what caused her downfall, I believe.
Then would you still say that the fates were against her, or the fates played a role?
Well, that's a hypothetical situation, so it's not what's in the book, so you can't really answer that. Do you think that the setting had to do a lot with what, how, at the very beginning of the book, the setting that Shakespeare gives us sort of heightens the Capulets and the Montagues that are fighting? Do you think that that is a good way to show that, I have no clue what I'm saying.
I think that, since he sets the story in a walled city torn by two factions, the Capulets and the Montagues fighting, it already puts tension, because in a walled city, everybody is affected by everything that happens. And so when the city splits in half, and there's civil war and chaos.
Well, since the city that it was placed in, which is Verona, it was almost as a small microcosm. It all worked together, and that's what the prince strove for. He strove for peace and harmony, and since the strife between the two families was so great, it upset the whole city, and the whole city was up in an uproar, and so that plays a big part in the whole play.
Okay, if I want to end it now, does anybody have a final statement?
Without the chain of being, you can't understand why anything happened through Romeo and Juliet, because it's sort of like jumping into something without context. It's impossible to interpret it.
They did explain that the chain of being is a Renaissance worldview. I hope they said that to you. Thank you very much, students. And let me say, we finished Romeo and Juliet in April, and we finished school about a month ago, so this is pretty good. They did sort of collaborate, so it did not have the total flavor of an unplanned score discussion, but at least I hope you got some of the feel when they look at each other and they go back and forth. Well, I believe this, I believe that, and they can pose questions to each other. Now, we only have a few more minutes, so to debrief, I would ordinarily want to talk with the entire class about how they scored them. We'd compare the grades, if it's a practice time. If it's not a practice time and I'm the only one scoring on the junior high level, then we debrief in terms of all the class gets to then say, well, when Ben said so-and-so, and when Ashley added this, and everybody else, so we have an extended, even more of a discussion on something. Now, with the graded Socratic probes, those of you who were scoring, I saw some of you actually were. Was it difficult to do? Yeah, because you weren't with us and you don't know the extent of our studies, but still, it's difficult. You have to really listen, and you have to remember what Ben said to see if anybody else jumps in on it, to see if they've amplified it with an example or if they've just said something. I don't know if you noticed that, but some of them said, well, when Friar Lawrence said this, or when Prologue announced the star-crossed lovers, or that gets a little bit more points because they've referred to a distinct thing. Okay. Yes, wait. Let me say what I want to say about it. Okay.
Whenever they make a comment, can you give them more than 1 point for that? I mean, can you score them on several different issues, or can you score for one?
It depends on how rich that comment was. Sometimes they can end up with 4 points or maybe even five or something. It was extremely rich. But usually I'm deciding where to put the point. Should it be a 1 point or a 2 point or a 3 point, depending, okay? It's just that really some of the subject, pretty subjective sometimes in there. Okay, the graded Socratic probes, I have handouts here for you. Don't forget to take it. But what that is Socratic questioning, one-on-one, you and the student. Never do it in junior high. I only do it in high school for 20 to 30 minutes. So the whole classroom, the class is listening. They take notes. I expect them to take notes. I want to see their notes. They have to turn in their notes. And it's on a particular item, because what you're doing is you're probing deeply into the student's understanding of something. At the same time, you're probing deeper and deeper and deeper into the document or the event or the movement that you are probing the student on. So you got that? You're probing in deeper and deeper into your topic and deeper into the student's understanding. So we did one this year on the Communist Manifesto. So some of the students were assigned to Section 1. Some of them were assigned to Section 2. I only have hearing in one ear. So the probes, we couldn't do them all in one day because each one is 20 to 30 minutes. So the most successful ones for me were the ones we did in the classroom. I could hear. Well, then we went over a few blocks away to Starbucks and had coffee and sat around on the couch and did two probes there, and I had a very difficult time hearing them because with one ear, all the sound is the same. I can't pull out one particular sound and focus on it. It's very difficult. And then there was one lone probe I had to do with the student alone. The rest of the class wasn't there because he had missed school during this time. So I would recommend, the reason why I bring this up is to do these probes. You might just try various different settings and situations. But whenever the class is in it, make sure they take notes. Okay, you have warned them, you have told them, it is definitely a planned event. We're having we're having a probe next Thursday and Friday on so-and-so. And it might be the Constitution, it might be, you know, a theory in geography, or whatever, Bible, something. Okay, I open with specific questions, such as, when was this written, who was the author, what you know about the background, what you understand about the background of this. Now, this handout, you don't even need to write. I've got this handout for you. So just relax here for the last few minutes. Then, okay, that is surface questioning. Then I take one step forward, symbolically, not physically, and I start asking some clarification questions to clarify what this student has read and what he is telling me on the surface, what he thinks it is, such as, explain what you think his main point is. Well, how did he arrive at the main point? How did you arrive to the idea that was his main point? Where is he going to go to elaborate on this principle or main idea? Can you give me a good example here in the document? Where does it, how many supports does he use for that? You know, those kinds of questions. Those are clarifications. You're just clarifying what's there. Then you take another step closer, and these are when you tackle assumption questions. You're going to ask him to see what he has assumed about what he read or studied. And through the clarifying questions, you're going to pick up something where you can start asking some assuming questions. So I say, David, it seems that you assume so-and-so, so-and-so. One of the students was real excited by Section 1 of Communist Manifesto. He said, gosh, if Karl Marx were a Christian. But see, he didn't know the repercussions yet. He's only a junior. He didn't know. And he was looking only on the surface. He was making some assumptions about the language that Marx used. He was assuming that the vocabulary is similar. I mean, all these things. So there I started probing his assumptions on his excitement about Section 1. Well, you are assuming that so-and-so. Is this true? Do I understand you? Do you think that your assumption is rather narrow, or could it be possible you are giving him too much credit being a Christian with a Christian worldview? You're not all that acquainted with his worldview. Those kinds of questionings. Your reasoning and your assumptions depend on what section of this document. Could there be more than a mere assumption in this? I mean, would you take another step closer and probe deeper into him and deeper into the document with another set of questions, which is his reasonings and his evidence for assuming that this document or the ideas in your document will have these kinds of consequences. So it's questions such as, can you give me some examples from history? Can you give me an example for how Stalin modeled his revolution on Karl Marx, or in actuality didn't, because he was not Marxian? Can you give me some examples from China or from Cuba or on the consequences of Marx's ideas and Marx's reasons? Well, what other kind of information from real life can you give me? Well, what kind of consequences could you see from this idea in Scripture? Those kinds. Probing for reasons, probing for evidence of his reasons for taking a particular position on how he reads the document. Okay, another step closer. Okay, you've gone from just your basic clarifications. You've tried to kind of wipe him away here with the assumptions and for him to realize, whoa, I had better do a little bit more study when I read a document like that. And you're going to start thinking about sources. Where do you see in his document any evidence of Marx's sources for his ideas? Are there any clues here? What philosophers that you know that he has studied in Germany or in London or wherever? Have there been any statesmen or national upheavals or circumstances that affected Marx's formulation of his belief in dialectic materialism and those kind of things, et cetera, et cetera? Another step closer, and you're going to probe the implications on Christian truth, on God's integrity, on nations, on history, on anything of Marx's ideas. Only in Section 1, because his student's only responsible for Section 1. It's when you get to Section 2 that you're just blown out of the water. You see the evil, evil, evil of it. So very last aspect is you're going to probe the student's possible change in his evaluation of Marx's document once you've proceeded in this conversation where you've asked a certain set of questions at each interval in the conversation, in the probe, and come up with some sensible way to wrap it up. Now, by that time, you're pretty wiped out, you know, but because you're trying to think with him, but think against him, and think the Scripture, think wisdom, and all that sort of thing. So the graded Socratic probes, I wish I could do more with it, but let me tell you, in terms of finding sources all over the Internet, in this handout are things that I've put together and spliced and piled together from things on the Internet. I didn't make this up, so it does not have my name on it like the other one does. And it's a great tool, wonderful. I encourage you to do it. You block out some time because you're going to spend time with every upperclassman 20 to 30 minutes probing his understanding of something. But see, he's responsible to give a defense of his studies not continue to get by with a superficial study of anything. And in your history classes or your chemistry or whatever, they're connecting the ideas, and they've got to look at assumptions that they're making and other people have made, and you've got to look at consequences of everything. So it's a fun thing. Okay, that's all we have on this seminar, and I trust you're being blessed by being here in Cincinnati, and God bless each one of you, and don't forget the handout. Thank you.